learn what it means to be a Baptist. I just pray that you would help me to be clear in the way that I present the material, and that these folks would have questioning minds, and that they would learn much through this time. And Lord, we ask your blessing on it, and we want to commit it to you in Jesus' name. Amen. So when I mention separation of church and state, I know for me, in my own mind, this was one of those distinctives that was a little bit confusing to me. Mostly because the idea of separating my church life, my spiritual life, separating that from maybe how I vote or how that just kind of seemed like it rubbed me the wrong way. We've all had pastors and teachers who say, you know, for a believer, everything is sacred. We don't compartmentalize our life. Everything that has to do with the gospel, it should transcend every part of our life. So when I heard of the Baptist distinctive of separation of church and state, sometimes, as I mentioned, it kind of makes me, it's kind of an anomaly in my mind, if you will. So what we do with this idea, what do we do with this idea of separating the church and state? How does it affect our lives? And in order to answer that question or those questions, we're going to look at some various aspects of what it means to separate church and state. And we're going to look at the history. We're going to look at its main underlying doctrine. And then we're going to look at the application of these doctrines to our church here. And so let's begin with, as you have on your handout, the history of the historical basis for separating church and state. See, we have to, in order to really understand the necessity of separating the government from our church, we have to really go back to the beginning of Christianity to really understand that. And so I want us to kind of transform ourselves to think about what it would be like in early Christianity. Many times in the first century, all believers were first generation believers. You know, your mom and dad was probably not a believer. In fact, I'm fairly certain that they would not be, your ancestors would not be Christians. They might be Jewish and they might be religious, but they would not be Christians. And so when Christianity came onto the scene in the early pages of Acts, a lot of things were taking place in the personal lives of those who would choose to follow Christ. One of those things was you would accept Christ as your Savior, and really that was you took your political, your citizenship, you took your familial, all of those, that those aspects of your life, all of those were completely different when you chose to follow Christ. And so many times you would be shunned, you would be ostracized, you'd be kicked out of your family. And really, in the first century, family was everything. And so many young believers, they found themselves persecuted because they named the name of Christ. And really, in first century Christianity, being a believer was pretty much illegal. You know, the state sought to quell any radical views that would endanger the peace of the region. You know, we look back in the first century, and who was in charge? Well, Rome was in charge. And Rome, what they would do is they would conquer, and then they would set up little puppet governments, and then they would just kind of watch, and they would kind of keep the peace. And so anything that would cause any kind of dissension or any kind of grumblings or any kind of riots or anything, they really sought to quell that and keep that under wraps. And so we have these early Christians who they started preaching against certain things in their culture. And so then it caused other individuals to kind of rub them the wrong way. And people started kind of getting upset with Christians and Christianity. And so Rome had to step in and they had to kind of quell any type of rebellion or any type of turmoil. And so in some cases, Christianity was seen as a threat to the sovereignty of the state. And another aspect we understand, as I mentioned before, is it really did divide families. Matthew chapter 10 talks about that when Christ says that he was going to bring enmity between fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons, mothers and daughters. And so really the gospel can be a divisive thing between believers and unbelievers. Unbelievers, of course, don't appreciate the message of the gospel. It's foolishness to them. And many times when we see something that is foolishness to us, there is an animosity towards that thing. Well, that's what happened in early Christianity. And then we see in Acts, we see the apostles starting to preach and to teach. And then we had government officials who would haul them before judges and would beat them and would throw them in prison. And they would command, you know, you need to stop preaching. You need to stop preaching Christ. And we have Acts chapter 5 where it says, where we have calls for obedience to God rather than man. And so that's early Christianity. Well, as Christianity was beginning to continue to grow and lay its foundation, there was a Roman emperor named Diocletian who came to power, and he saw Christianity as a huge, huge threat to his sovereignty as well as the sovereignty of Rome. And so he made it his personal goal, his personal mission to really wipe out Christianity. And so he started a great persecution, and really he was so effective in his persecution of the believers that many Romans looked at the Roman Empire and said, well, you know, I think we've pretty much wiped out Christianity. I think we've pretty much silenced these radicals. We've pretty much silenced these people who would come and tell us how they were part of another kingdom rather than Rome. And so I think we pretty much wiped them out. Well, ironically, the next king or the next emperor who took power from Diocletian was a guy by the name of Constantine. And Constantine, he was kind of a religious individual, a very spiritual individual. And one day he had a vision. Now, I don't know the nature of the vision. I didn't do a whole lot of study on Constantine and his conversion. But after that vision, then he claimed Christianity as his religion. And really, he started to started looking at his kingdom or his empire, and he really saw the how Christians were mistreated, how they were fired, how they were removed from positions of authority, in some cases killed. And he thought, you know what, this is not right. We're going to completely do a 180 from what was true in the empire. And so Constantine really started to implement Christianity rather than the opposite of Christianity, paganism. And he set up, he was the first emperor that really kind of, the first individual that really kind of meshed church and state. He viewed himself as a spiritual leader. And so, you know, when it came to doctrinal issues, he thought, well, you know, I'm a believer. I should be able to make statements and make judgments on religious things. And so he sought to really be a leader in the church. But then also he was an emperor. And so he decided, well, let's just mesh them together and see what happens. I think this is what we need to do. And so he meshed for the first time in history the state and church together. They were linked. And in fact, he linked them in such a way that instead of persecuting Christians, he did, like I said, a 180. And instead, he started persecuting paganism. And he started really endorsing Christianity and the teachings of Christianity. And this brought about some very interesting consequences, both good consequences and then bad consequences. The good consequences was, for the first time in a long time, believers were finally free to exercise their belief without really any fear of persecution. In fact, there are many incentives that Constantine laid out for believers. And so that was a good consequence. Another good one was that believers were actually rewarded, as I mentioned. Paganism was severely limited through punishment. And so Christianity, for the first time, thought, well, you know what? We can finally breathe. We can finally just go back to our lives. We can finally live quiet and peaceable life. And this is a good thing. But along with the good came some bad consequences. And though these were unintentional, they still really did major damage to the relations between the church and the state. See, unintentionally, the unsaved people, they started looking at Christians and they started seeing those incentives and the tax breaks and the positions of authority and popularity that these believers now were thrust into. And they started thinking, well, you know what? I want that too. And how do I get that? How do I achieve this prestige? How do I achieve these places of prominence? And so what these unsaved individuals started doing is they thought, well, you know what? I can look like a Christian. You know, I can claim the name of Christ. And I can, you know, I'm a good guy. And I can take this baptism that they're talking about, and I could say that I'm a Christian. And so sometimes and many times what started happening was unbelievers in cities started saying, well, I'm a believer. You know, Christians were only supposed to be holding places of authority. And so people would ask, you know, are you a believer? Well, yeah, of course I am. Sure, I'll be baptized. No problem. If that means I can get the perks of being a believer. And so unintentionally, unsaved individuals, they started naming the name of Christ because they wanted to escape punishment as well as to achieve prominence, prestige, and places of prominence in community. And so then true Christianity was overrun at this point by unbelieving hypocrites. And it actually did much to diminish the potency of the gospel. See, it meant something early on to be a believer. You had to put everything on the line to name the name of Christ. Well, now it's just, hey, if I want a good life, I'll just tack on Jesus and it's no problem. And so we have the church really being overrun by unbelievers. And at this point, Constantine decided, you know what, we need to have something that will separate the unbelievers and the believers. And so what we're going to do is we're going to implement the necessity of baptism. And so you start to see where baptism starts being that sign. And so the true meaning of baptism starts diminishing. And then we have people who, in order to enter the official church, and as they look at the opportunities that were there for them, if they would just take this baptism, then people just started saying, okay, sure. You know, I want all these good things in life, and so sure, I'll take baptism. And so things really, from the end of Constantine all the way through the Middle Ages, that's what you really saw. In order to have identity in a community, in order to have any government perks, any government protection, you were linked to the church, but really it was only on an economic and no real spiritual, there was no regeneration that took place. And in turn, the state would look at that and say, okay, well, you are baptized. So sure, we will give you protection and we will give you these opportunities. And so that is what happened in the Middle Ages. Well, then we came to the end of the Middle Ages. As we're coming to the end of the Middle Ages, something starts happening. reformers and individuals started noticing that, you know, these people are really being led astray by the government. They're being led astray by the church and how it's linked together. And so they thought, you know what, we need to find, it all started with, we need to have people be able to read the Bible. You know, God gave it to us. We should be able to have everybody read it. And so we had guys like Tyndale, and we had guys like Luther, who started coming onto the scene, and they started doing study on their own, and it started a reformation where people started really for the first time hearing the gospel, and they started recognizing, hey, guess what? Now that I'm a believer, I think baptism, as we found doing this study in Baptist Distinctives, I think the only people who really are baptized, should be baptized, are believers. So they started thinking about that, and they started kind of grouping together as individuals who believed that true baptism only happens after conversion. And so then we started to have people who said, I think I need to be baptized again. And so we had people who were rebaptized, and these individuals were called Anabaptists. Now, obviously, if you look at what the church and the state were doing as they were linked, now we have individuals who are starting to do things that seem to go contrary to, as I mentioned before, keeping everything just kind of quiet and the status quo. Now we have people starting to teach things differently and then believe things differently and then act differently. And so the church and the state, because they were linked, came in and started saying, no, you can't be doing that. And really they started, the persecution started ramping up once again. Now, these Anabaptists, what their reaction was, well, hey, you know what? If you're going to take this, all this stuff away from us, well, I don't care. We're just going to pretty much, you know, separate from any taking any oaths, holding any office, serving in the military. So you're not going to, if you're not going to accept that we have come to different beliefs, we're just going to back out of society. Well, this continued persecution. So you had the big circle that just continued. And a century later, an offshoot of this movement began to take hold in a place called England. It began as an offshoot to the English separatism. It was a branch of the English Reformation. And these individuals were, rather than being called Anabaptists, they were just called Baptists. It was just shortened. And they still encountered some persecution, but one thing that was different about them, the Baptists, in I think it was about the 1600s, when you're dealing with pilgrims and you're dealing with those who are seeking religious freedom, one thing that was different about them is they didn't necessarily withdraw from society quite as much as the Anabaptists did. And so we have kind of a little bit of a different interaction between the church at this point and the state. And the movement was characterized by several tenets. And really, we as Baptists now would probably agree with pretty much all of these tenets. The first one being that the coercive power of the state must not be used to enforce matters that should be left to the conscience before God. And we're going to talk about the nature of true devotion in a second to kind of explain that first tenet a little bit better. But then the next tenet was Christianity should not appeal to the state for support or advantage. And then third, the best attitude of the state toward matters of religion is simply to ensure that people have liberty to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. And then lastly, the state has no right to either establish a religion or to prohibit its free exercise. And I don't know if that sounds familiar to you, but that sounds pretty similar to our Bill of Rights in our Constitution. And so we have these Baptists who really put together, and I don't know if we can necessarily at that point call them Baptists, but we have these separatists who come to America and the early colonies, and we have guys like Roger Williams, who even in the colonies was shunned, left from Massachusetts Bay Colony and sent out into the wilderness to die. And what he did is he then went and founded Rhode Island. And if you've ever done the study of Rhode Island Colony, the colony was there primarily so that anybody at any time can meet and have free free reign to worship God. And there was no real state connection. There was no real persecution. It was just you get to meet with God depending on your conscience and as your conscience dictates. And so the question is, why are Baptists so strongly committed to the separation of church and state? And it really comes down to, as I mentioned before, it's because of the nature of true devotion. See, Baptists believe that only devotion offered to, or that the only true devotion offered to God must come from the heart to be that acceptable worship. See, merely formal religious exercises are an offense to God and merit only judgment for those who practice them. Let's turn in our Bibles to John chapter 4, and we can get a little bit better picture of what this looks like. John chapter 4. It's a very popular passage. It's talking about the woman at the well. And let's look at verses 19 through 24. Verse 19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." Jesus had just told her to go and get her husband. The woman at the well obviously didn't have a husband. And really, Christ nailed her to the wall. And so in order to kind of change the subject, she begins to talk about worship. And so continuing on in verse 20, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship Him. God is the Spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth." And so we're going to stop right there. This was really an interesting discourse to me. We have a woman who is really called out by Christ for the sin that she is involved in. And the lady responds by, let's just change the subject. And so she starts talking about worship. And the interesting thing about Christ is he doesn't necessarily go back and say, well, no, let's just talk a little bit more about these guys that you're living with. No, he goes and he takes and answers her questions, but then he loops it back into the gospel again and back into talking about him being the Messiah. And really, through that, we actually get a window, a view of what true worship really is. And what is true worship? Well, true worship is doing it in spirit, worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Now, I want us to think, if you walk into this church today, or if you were to walk into this church today, and there were guys with M16s behind you, and they were to say, "All right, I want everyone worshiping God in the next 5 minutes, or I'm going to start opening up on you." I don't know about you, but there would not be much worshipful thoughts going on in my heart. More would be fear. More it would be, boy, I better do this or I am in serious trouble. And so it would be an outward show. It wouldn't be anything from inward. There would be no warmness. It would be cold and it would be rote memorization. It would be, I'm just going to say the right things. I'm just going to get through this and then we're going to move on. And really, when you think about it, in the Middle Ages and in other situations where church and state are connected, When the church or when the state has determined a national religion, if you will, really true worship, it ceases to exist. people gather because their motives are completely different than just getting together to worship their God. They're getting together to, okay, we have to appease the people who are behind us, who are, and we have to worship in a certain way. And there's only a certain tradition that we have to follow because that's what the state is pleased with. And so we will gather and we will submit and we will, but really, does true worship ever take place? And the point that Baptists really came to was no. No, true devotion really is never coerced. When coercion takes place, that true worship, it really does cease. And we can see in Matthew chapter 15 where there was a group of individuals who they were accused of having mouths that worship, but their hearts were far from God. Those were the Pharisees. And people can seem religious and they can do religious things, but that does nothing more than to give man's recognition. And so let's think about on God's perspective, when people are coerced and it's not true, it's not done in spirit and in truth, is God pleased with that type of religion or that type of worship? No. And so the major teaching under the nature of true devotion is that government cannot legislate righteousness or worship. They can put up signs that say, speed limit 55, but really, can they change your heart to make you want to go 55? No. And you may be at 55, but inside you're flooring that thing. And you're burning rubber, and you see a stop sign, and you're like, oh, I gotta stop, but really, I don't want to. And so they can legislate outward action, but they cannot legislate righteousness. It can enforce an external conformity, but they can never really secure the heart's allegiance. Under coercion, people may go through expected external rituals, but inwardly they remain hardened and unchanged. And so the question is then, all right, what is our relationship to the state? We know that they can enforce laws and put rules around us, but they can't really change our hearts. So then how do I interact with the state? What is our responsibilities? What is our demeanor towards the state? And really, to answer that, we have to look at a couple of New Testament passages. Remember, one of the Baptist distinctives is we allow the New Testament to determine our doctrine as well as our practice. And so we're going to look at a few passages. You don't have to turn there. We don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm not going to necessarily read them, but I'll just kind of reference what's going on in them. We're going to look at the book of Acts. And we're going to find that nowhere do the apostles really appeal for special privilege or special exemption or special treatment for churches. And in Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5, we have Christians who are clashing with the Sanhedrin. We have the Sanhedrin who are rounding up believers and they are persecuting and they're saying you shouldn't be preaching this way. And really you have a very telling response by the apostles when they make it clear that their authority doesn't come from this governing body. They reject the power of the court to really govern what they say. They realize that their power and their authority doesn't come from people who sit behind a bench with a gavel in their hand. Their authority comes from God Himself, who told them, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. That's where their authority comes from. So we have Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5. But then we have Acts chapter 12, where Herod decides that he's going to interject himself into the Christianity situation. And you see the narrative when he kills James, he imprisons Peter. And we can really see that Herod and the government was entirely hostile towards Christianity and the things that Christianity were teaching. You look at Acts chapter 16, Paul and Silas, they're imprisoned for preaching. And after being miraculously released, the leadership of the city implored the evangelist to depart. Paul and Silas refuses. They claim mistreatment based not on Christianity or on based on their belief, but simply because those leadership, there was a collapse of Roman due process. Paul says, hey, you know what? You can't treat me this way, not because I'm a Christian, but you can't treat me this way because I'm a Roman citizen. And I love that passage because as they are about to whip Paul, they're about to bring it down, and he says something about, you know, hey, you know, I'm a Roman citizen and you didn't really give me due process. All of a sudden it was like, oh man. And I can just imagine those guys' face turning completely white, because back in the Romans were not to be punished. Roman citizens were not to be punished unless they went through due process. And so Paul doesn't stand there and he's not holding on to the post about to get whipped. And he's not saying, you can't do this, I'm a Christian. He says, you can't do this, I'm a Roman citizen and you didn't do due process. And so there really was no connection between Paul and the state in religious ways, if you will. Rather, he was completely okay to claim Roman citizenship and Roman due process, and it was apart from anything religious. Then you go to Acts chapter 18, and once again Paul's imprisoned and he's charged with false doctrine, and then he goes before a guy by the name of Gallio, and actually Gallio refuses to hear the case. And he cites that he has no place to govern in areas of religion. Really, he's like, that's above my pay grade. That's not my realm. It's not my jurisdiction. And we have an interesting response by the Apostle Paul when Gallio recuses himself. Paul accepts that without any hesitation. And he is completely okay with this decision, and that decision to recuse himself, as well as Paul's reaction to that, really does prove again the separation, the separate nature of the government and the church. And then we look at Acts chapter 24 through 26, and that's when Paul goes before Felix, Festus, Agrippa. He presents himself as a man who is free from any type of crime. Any type of criminal wrongdoing. He doesn't come once again and say, hey, you can't treat me like this, I'm a Christian. He comes before him and says, hey, take a look at me. Have I broken the law? And actually, a couple of these guys were like, oh, I can't charge this guy. And so they keep sending him to the next guy. And they're like, I don't want to deal with that. You know, Felix says, send him over to Festus. He'll deal with that. I don't want to touch that one. And then Festus says, we'll send it to Agrippa. And so Paul just continues to say, oh, I'll keep going. I'll keep talking to these people because I haven't done anything wrong. I'm not a criminal. I'm not inciting riots. I'm just there. I'm just living my life. And so we have this separation that takes place between government and religion. Now, some have insisted that this separation was merely for this little bit, this first few hundred years when Christianity was weak and there really was no infiltration into the political realm. And some have said, well, now that we're stronger, now that Christianity is firmly established, now we have the right, the responsibility, the duty to then infiltrate and to bring civil authority under our jurisdiction, under Christianity's power. But really, this rings hollow. If you search the New Testament, you will search in vain for any indication that the union of the church and the state would ever really be desirable. We are of a different kingdom. We are citizens of a different kingdom, a different realm, a different government, if you will, for lack of a better term. We're citizens of heaven. We're citizens of the kingdom of God. And so you look, as I mentioned, you search in vain in the New Testament to find any indication that this would be a good thing to mesh these two together in this world. So then here's the question. Now we start to get to the applicational aspect. What is Baptist relationship to civil authority? Remember I mentioned Anabaptists, what their reaction was, hey, we're going to step out of community. We're going to step out of citizenship. We're going to give it all up and we're going to almost be like hermits living however we want. Well, that's one way. Baptists, though, were much more positive, much more patient with the political realm. And we see a couple of principles. One is submission and participation in civil authority. See, what is and what has been the Baptist view concerning interaction with civil authority has a threefold answer. Number one, it's that God has appointed civil authority to which Christians must submit in civil affairs. You know, God is very clear. 1 Peter talks about how we are to submit ourselves. 2 Timothy talks about how we are, 1 Timothy, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but they talk about how we are to pray for our authority so that we can live quiet and peaceable lives under their authority. Who is the one who implemented government? Well, God did. And so in one way, we submit to God when we submit to the governmental authorities in our lives. And so we are to submit. However, number two is that in matters of conscience, really the state possesses no authority. As I mentioned, they can set up rules and guidelines to protect the safety as well as the defense of its citizens. But in matters of conscience, really they don't have that power. They don't have that ability. They don't have that right. And then number three, Christians may participate in civil affairs. They can swear oaths when required to do so. They can hold office when called and even wage war when necessary. And that's been the Baptist beliefs in regard to submission and participation within civil authority. Now, I know of one gentleman in the room who is very involved in the political process in our community. And he goes and he sits on different boards and he sits on different committees and he has a voice in choosing the next political individuals who are going to be in authority. I know of individuals who have served in the military who are sitting in this auditorium, in this room, who they swear an oath to the Constitution to defend it. And then, you know, there's probably individuals that have sworn an oath, maybe not in necessarily political realms, but, you know, you are about trying to bring about further righteousness within your community, and maybe that has some sort of civil authority role. And so how do we interact? We submit and we are able and we are allowed to have participation. However, that submission and participation is not absolute. There is civil disobedience. And while appearing contradictory to their statements on submission, there are two exceptions where we can have some civil disobedience. Most obviously, we are commanded to disobey anyone or anything when a moral imperative is at stake. Acts 5:29 says, we ought to obey God rather than man. When there is a conscience issue, we have the directive from God to follow God first. And I think Pastor, he went through a series of sermons on how we respond to civil authority and how we are able to, or we are called to disobedience in some cases. And so if you'd like more information on that, I would urge you to go onto the website and listen to those sermons. He did a great job with that. But most obviously, we are commanded to disobey anyone or anything when a moral imperative is at stake. You look at Daniel chapter 3, and we've been talking about Daniel and learning about Daniel. And they are, and individuals are to maintain a purity before God. And in this case, they stated it right out. And this is the narrative of Daniel's three friends. When Nebuchadnezzar says, you must bow when the music plays. And they say, no, we're going to follow God rather than you. And so that's the most obvious. But then also we are called to civil disobedience when an official commands, decrees that we break another law. As I mentioned before, Paul is placed in jail despite process of Roman law, due process that was afforded to him. He had those rights that the Roman government gave to him. And he said, no, you cannot break the law by kind of just leave town, just get out of here. We don't want to deal with you anymore. And Paul says, no, I have every right to be here. And actually the leadership was actually trying to cover their own tracks and by asking Paul to leave quietly. And then Paul rightly refused and claimed that the leadership themselves were the ones who actually broke the law. And so if we ever get pulled over by the police and they ask us to do something that breaks the law further, we have every right to say, no way. You cannot ask me to do that certain thing because that would break another law. And so we have every right to disobey in those two situations. So we've seen that Baptists have been strongly committed to the separation of church and state. But at the same time, they supported the rightness of individuals' Christian involvement in government affairs. But what does that practically look like for us in the 21st century? Are we in the 21st century? 20th? Yeah, it's not the 20th century. 20, yeah, okay, 21st century. What are the practical implications in relation to churches, pastors, and politics? And the first step to really understanding how First Calvary interacts with the state and the government is we have to understand what is the church's mission. And I'm going to try to fly through these because we don't have a whole lot of time. What is the mission of the church? Well, Matthew chapter 28 and 19 clearly lays out for us what the mission is. It is to go into all the world and preach the gospel. And we're to make disciples. Now that is spiritual in nature. I think you would agree with me when I make that assertion. Then you look at Ephesians chapter 4 and verses 11 through 16. And these are tests of a healthy church. And we have things such as unity in the faith, unity of the full knowledge of the Son of God, mature spiritual manhood, conformity to the full character of Christ. Now once again, these are spiritual in nature. And so there is the mission of the church primarily and first and foremost is a spiritual mission. However, that spiritual mission does roll out practically to a moral responsibility of the church to the world at large. We do have moral responsibility to the people who walk by our church. Ephesians 5, 3 through 14 talks about the works of the flesh and how we are not to have any part of them. We are to not be participants in the works of darkness, sexual sin, greed, foolish speech, etc. It goes on and continues to talk about the flesh, works of the flesh. So we're not to participate in the works of darkness, but here's what we are to do. We are to reprove them. There is nothing wrong with us saying, hey, you know what? You shouldn't be doing that. And the reason that you shouldn't be doing that is not because you'll get in trouble with the government. But the reason you shouldn't be doing that is because God says, don't do that. And so we are called to reprove those around us when they do wrong, when they do evil. See, we let the world know what God thinks about it from the Word. We're called to be those evangelists, those, if you will, prophets. To say, no, God says this. You shouldn't be doing that. And really has no, that role really has no real governmental role. It's just citizens saying, hey, this is what God says. You shouldn't be doing that. And then preaching the gospel based on that. And so Christians' political responsibility is we look at the mission of the church. It's primarily spiritual. We look at the moral responsibility, and really there's a spiritual aspect to that as well. And so for us to stand up and to have political rallies and to say you should vote for this candidate or not this candidate, and really that is left up to the people in the congregation. Now we can preach the principles in the God's Word and allow people to make those connections, and hopefully they will. But really, Pastor Mike's job is not to stand up and say, you should vote Democrat, you should vote Republican, you should vote independent. That's not his role. His role is to talk about the gospel and talk about what is in the Word. And so we have an example. If you need further study on how we should interact, we have an example that we've actually been studying. Pastor Mike has been showing us, and really that example is in the man Daniel. And we have seen Daniel over and over again. He provides a great example of a man that God used to serve within a government of unbelieving kings and leadership. And specifically, Daniel understood who was in complete sovereign control of God and himself. We've seen it over and over again. Who's on the throne? God is on the throne. And then he also understood that God judges nations, God judges the kings, God judges the leadership. Daniel chapter 4 talks about how God broke Nebuchadnezzar's pride. Daniel chapter 5 talks about how God judged Belshazzar. Daniel chapter 6, God protected Daniel from the designs of wicked leadership, and he found himself in the lion's den. And so how do we as believers, how does First Calvary Baptist Church respond to the civil authority? What is the relationship? Well, in Western politics, the interesting thing is each one of us, in one sense, the way we have our government set up, we have opportunity to, in one sense, propagate or to bring about rule, if that makes sense to you. In kind of a weird way, we have opportunity as in a democracy or a representative republic, we can in some cases bring about certain governmental institutions or the way, the direction, the modus operandi, if you will, of how a government will govern. And so what are our responsibilities? Our responsibilities is to do whatever is necessary or whatever is within our realm or in our privilege to bring about further righteousness in our culture. So we vote. So we, in some cases, we serve in the military. In some cases, we have chaplains. In some cases, we have governmental officials. But really, there is a difference. There still is, even though we do those things, there still is a separation that exists. Baptists have been about separation of church and state for a very, very long time. And they do it with very good reasons for why they deem it necessary to separate. Separate really two institutions that God had put into practice, into play. And so we come to the final Baptist distinctive. And while it might still be a little bit confusing at different times, why should I want to separate the church and the state? Really, I hope that it's been a little bit clearer now that there is true, for the sake of true devotion, true worship, we do want to have that separation take place. Any questions, real quick?